Now, you remember some time ago I said that eschatology is not my favorite of all the loci of theology, because it is a subject so very broad and so very variegated, varied. There are as many eschatological positions as there are people on the planet. And so trying to compact a study of eschatology down into something understandable is a great feat, to say the least. So I must confess that I've struggled with how to even get started, where to even get started, how to, you know, navigate through this subject in a way that would make some sense to you, especially if you've never studied eschatology before. So I've come up with what I think is a way to do this, all right? And so tonight is going to be an introduction to general eschatology, and then we'll begin moving into some more details of it. We'll get some details tonight, but we'll get more details as we go along. Now, let me remind you that eschatology as a subject is not limited to the end of the world. Yes, I realize the word eschaton is the end, but eschatology itself isn't really only about the end of the world. That is the part of it that we most often think of. That's the first thing we think of when we think of eschatology. How's the world going to end, right? That's kind of the issue. Okay. But eschatology really is a general study of time more than it is even of how time ends. In a sense, all eschatological systems embrace a full-orbed sense of how time itself unfolds from the beginning to the end. And so how you start and where you flow and how you see things go ultimately determines what you think is going to happen as it all comes to an end. You find most eschatological systems, in fact, that focus on the end, in many ways you have to rewind quite a ways to get where they're coming from to begin with to determine how they got here. Okay, so that's the thing. So you have to deal with the timeline from creation through the Old Testament to Christ through the church age to the return of Christ and then beyond in order to figure out what's going on. Okay. So each eschatological system understands the future events of redemptive history in light of the framework of time itself, or as they see it. So a timeline of eschatological history is essential to each system, and I think essential to understanding how they all might work together, okay? And so what we're really talking about here is something called a meta-narrative. You heard this word before? A meta-narrative. A meta-narrative is a way of understanding specific events in time over against an overarching story that sits over the top. A meta-narrative is that narrative above the narrative. It's a narrative that sits over the top of things. See, in Reformed theology, the meta-narrative is God's sovereign decree to accomplish what he wills in time and space. That's a meta-narrative. Everything else is individual details find their way into this meta-narrative. The story overarching is how you fit together all the individual events inside. So your meta-narrative determines how you understand things, okay? So in many ways, you have to start with a meta-narrative. You have to start with an overarching story. You have to start with the larger story of God's redemptive purpose into which all of the historical events fit along the way, okay? And there are differences of opinion on that meta-narrative, very much so, in different theological systems, okay? Now, I want to be clear about something up front here. It will not be my intention to defend a particular eschatological system beyond what we already agree upon in our statement of faith and is consistent with the bulk of Reformed theological frameworks, okay? So the meta-narrative that I'm going to espouse will be a simple one, very simple one, that'll be based on what we understand in general as Reformed theology, and then we'll discuss the other meta-narratives and the other eschatological systems that will flow to them, but I'm not going to attempt to defend any of them. Okay? And I'm certainly not going to defend my own. And the reason why is because, well, frankly, I don't really have one. All these years of studying eschatology, I've come to the realization I haven't got a clue. Okay? So, if you have a particular one that you are, die hard in the wool, fine, that's fine. You can go ahead and keep that. We're not going to try to talk you out of it. I'm not going to try to talk you into another one. We'll discuss each of the different eschatological systems. We'll try to do so fairly. I'll try to bring what I think is my understanding of it as best as I can. I'll try to be fair to each individual one, but we're not going to try to defend one over against all the others. Okay? We're not going to try to do that. We're going to try to be simplifying. You'll see why as we get into this. Because what I want to do now is this, okay? I want to use a story here. In Exodus 26, God gives to Moses and the people of Israel a very specific set of instructions about how to build the tabernacle. If you're with us in our Exodus study not too long ago, God came and gave to the Israelites a very specific set of instructions of how to build this tent where God would meet with his people, the priests would sacrifice, and where the Ark of the Covenant would be kept, the Holy of Holies, where God supposedly would dwell with his people. Okay, in Exodus 26, God gives very specific instructions about how to build it. And as part of the instruction process, he talks about, because it's a tent, about this framework that you had to build first, made out of wood, covered with gold, made out of acacia wood, covered with wood, with the tent pole stuck in bases in the ground. And then you built a latticework across that and hung the curtains, these great curtains made out of blue and scarlet and purple yarns, embossed with golden images of cherubim and seraphim in the drapes, and you would hang them on this framework. Okay? So, here's what I want us to do. I want us to think about time as a framework. I want us to think about time as a series of tent poles. We're gonna set some tent poles here along the way, okay? We're gonna establish these particular tent poles, and then we're gonna allow all of the different eschatological systems to hang the drapes on them any way they want. Okay? We're gonna just put the tent poles up first, but then we can move the curtains. I mean, some might put all the curtains over here, and some might put all the curtains over here, and some might bunch up a few here, and bunch up a few there, but that's okay. What we want first is a basic framework of redemptive history that all of the eschatological systems would agree on. No matter which eschatological position that you take, or all that are out there, generally speaking, there's a certain framework that all of them follow. So that's what I want to introduce. I'm going to call it a baseline historical timeline. It's consistent in all these eschatological systems. Now, these are events that what I would call them creedal or confessional minimums. Okay? Creedal or confessional minimums. Regardless of when you are in history or regardless of what view of history you have, these are sort of the creedal confessional minimums upon which all the eschatological systems agree, regardless of how the curtains are hung. In other words, we're going to put a post here and a post here and a post here and a post here, and everybody, no matter how they view history, is going to go, yeah, okay, I can buy that. Yep. So we're going to, that's where we have to start. And I would argue that they are fixed events that are revealed by Scripture as essential to the redemptive historical picture. They're essential. And everybody agrees that they're essential. Okay? So we're going to put some posts along the way. All right. So let's talk in two categories. Past tense, future tense. All right? Past tense is pretty easy because we're going to put two and only two tent poles up. First tent pole we're going to put up is the very first tent pole in the very beginning of human history. More specifically, what we're going to do is we're going to put a tent pole right there just as Adam falls into sin and God comes to him in chapter 3 and says to the serpent in chapter 3 verse 15 that a seed of the woman would come and crush the head of the serpent. So we're going to put a tent pole right here where redemptive history begins. Seems logical, right? Good place to start. Everybody agrees there's a start to redemptive history. It occurs when the fall occurs. It occurs when God makes a promise that the seed of the woman would come. Now, of course, we agree that that particular moment is ordained by an eternity going in that direction, but we need to put a tent pole, so we'll put one here. All right, so right at the beginning of time. Okay. The second one we're going to put is over here, and this one is at the life, death, burial, resurrection, ascension of Christ. All right, so we're going to put another one here where Christ himself comes. All right, now you can move it a little bit this way or that way, depending on whether you want it at the cross or the resurrection or at Pentecost or whatever. It doesn't matter to me. We're just going to stick one right about there because we're really putting it is at the first advent of Christ, the first coming of Christ. Okay, as he is incarnated, becomes human, his life then that he lives out over that period of time, his death, his burial, his resurrection, his ascension. Okay. So, in a sense, it's one event, because in many ways you could argue that the first advent of Christ is one event. He comes, he lives, he dies, he rises, he ascends. Okay, there's another tent pole in the history of the world. You could make the argument that it's at this, that you could move this tent pole to Pentecost, to Acts 2, about 50 days after Christ rises from the dead, right? About 10 days after he ascends, when the Spirit falls on the disciples, and they start speaking in tongues, and Peter goes out and tells everybody, listen, God ordained this, but you did it. Okay? Remember, I was talking on Sunday. Okay, so we could put it there. We could put it right there. Okay. Doesn't matter. Move it around a little bit. Doesn't matter. But there's a tent pole here at the beginning, and another one here when Christ. Now, I agree fully that there are a lot of other events between this tent pole and this one. Okay? Yep, there's a flood, and then there's Abraham, and then there's a law given under Moses, and then there's a split kingdom, and there's David, and all these things. There's a lot of other events that go on in between. I realize that, but these two tent poles are the ones that are most consistently included in the various eschatological systems. There's an accordion effect. Hang the curtains between the two any way you want to. How you understand the events going this way, that's entirely up to you. Everybody agrees, however, that there's a point here and a point here. Now, I'll come back to that thought in a minute, okay? And by the way, it is the interpretation and the application of these events that differentiates the various systems that we're talking about, how you interpret the events. The event itself happened. Abraham was called out of Ur around 2000 BC and landed in Canaan, right? I mean, we know that event. We know that the people of Israel came out of Egypt somewhere around 1440 BC, got the law around 1440 BC, and wound up in the Promised Land about 1400. Okay, we know that. And et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of other events that we could point to. But fundamentally, from an eschatological perspective, those two are the most important ones. Okay? Now, that's past tense. Now, let's go to the future tense. What do we do about future stuff? Okay? What we need to do here, I think, is in order to establish our tent poles, what we probably need to do is limit what the tent poles will be to just those events that are included in the confessions. And only the events included in the confessions. Okay? In other words, if you were to take out the 1689 and go to chapters 31 and 32, or the Westminster Confession and go to chapters 32 and 33, and looked at what those confession writers wrote, as well as other subordinate confessions like the Philadelphia and the New Hampshire, etc., what you would discover is that there's very little actually spoken of future tentpoles. But there are some that are very clearly identified in the confessions, meaning they are things that the confession writers simply assumed were going to take place. And Orthodox Christianity has embraced them. Okay? There are three. The first, we'll put a tent pole at the return of Christ. The second advent of Christ. There's no doubt that the New Testament teaches very clearly that the expectation was that Christ would return. The New Testament is very clear. You can't read the New Testament without coming to the very clear perspective that most, if not all, of the biblical writers of the New Testament expected Christ to return. Many of them expected him to return imminently, within their own lifetimes, And in fact, many of them drew conclusions. Paul sometimes drew conclusions about the way the church was to behave based on his assumption that Christ would return imminently. Now, it's been 2,000 years, but the New Testament is still clear that we expect Christ to return. All right, so we're going to put a tent pole at the return of Christ. Secondly, we're going to put a tent pole at the second thing that's mentioned in the confessions, and that's the resurrection. The resurrection, the general resurrection from the dead, the raising of all men to their glorified physical state, either in anticipation of their glory in the presence of God or their eternal reprobation. We made partial mention of this in our discussion of the intermediate state over the last couple of weeks. There will be a general resurrection from the dead. Let me just pause for a moment here and point out something. For many evangelicals today, the form of eschatology that they embrace is, I don't have a name for it, so I came up with one. I'm going to call it evangelical heavenism. Evangelical heavenism is the idea that the goal is for us to go to heaven. So for many evangelicals, their eschatology basically ends at their own personal eschatology when they go to heaven and that's it. What else do you need? I mean, I'm in heaven. So the return of Christ and the resurrection, in particular the resurrection, are often missed amongst discussions in evangelical circles. You can go to funerals by evangelical preachers and never hear the resurrection mentioned. Because, well, he's in heaven. So what more do we need? Okay, that's a form of evangelical heavenism. So these two tent posts that I just put up would not, in fact, be recognized by most modern evangelicals, in fact. In a strange and twisted sort of way. Okay? So we got one at the return of Christ. We got one at the resurrection. And a third one, the judgment. A time in which Christ gathers all men before himself and separates the elect from the reprobate to their appointed destinies. Now, this is, of course, the tent pole where the eternal state begins. Because those who are on his right go with him to the presence of God. Those who are on his left are cast away. And so the eternal state begins at this particular point. This is the divination, the dividing between those who belong and those who do not. Okay, so this is really the beginning of heaven and hell, the new heavens and the new earth, the culmination of the kingdom of Christ, etc., etc. All of which we'll talk about at some point in the future. But there's a tent pole there of the judgment. So, three. The confessions of the faith list three particular events. They don't attempt to qualify them. They simply establish them as tent poles in time. Christ will return. Christ will judge all men. Christ will raise all men. Christ will judge all men. Okay? So it's fairly simple. Now, these minimum elements are visible in every eschatological system. No matter how you understand the future unfolding, there's a sense in which, yes, Christ will return. Yes, all men will be raised. Yes, all men will be judged. So everybody knows of these three tent poles. The difference, of course, is how you hang the drapes in between the tent poles. Or exactly where in the sand do you put the base and then slide the pole in, okay? It might be slightly different from one position to another, but there's a sense in which there's a tent pole there. These are the minimum elements. There may be a number of different ways of hanging the actual historical events upon or around them. Now, you will notice that I did not include a tent pole for the millennium or the beginning of the millennium in my discussion. Okay? And I would argue that the same reason I did not is because the same reason I didn't include a tent pole at Abraham's birth or entry into Canaan or David's covenant or whatever. Okay? The fact of the matter is the millennium is not really a tent pole in this analysis for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's not mentioned in the confessions. It's not mentioned. There's no mention of a millennial kingdom in the confessions. Secondly, it is rejected as an historical event or an historical element of future history by some. But some will say, there is no millennium. And then thirdly, it is interpreted from Revelation 20, this idea of a millennium, by some as an overlap of the church age, as though they are co-consistent with one another. Now, when we get into a discussion of the millennium, and we will have a discussion of the millennium, we'll talk about what that means, okay? But I'm not putting a tent pole here because in many ways, it's not considered part of the confessions, and it's open to a massive amount of interpretation by every particular group. Okay, so it doesn't need a temple. We'll just call it part of the drapes. If you want to hang a millennium drape, go ahead. Then you decide where it starts and where it ends in accordance with this tentpole called the return of Christ. Now, what is ironic here, and I didn't think of this until I was writing this outline, is this. Isn't it interesting that most of these systems are defined by their view of the millennium? Postmillennialism, premillennialism, amillennialism, right? I mean, even dispensationalism is premillennial dispensationalism, effectively. Okay, so in other words, even though the millennium itself is never really mentioned in the confessions, it becomes the name by which all of these systems want to identify themselves, and they all make a definition of how they come out by where they would hang the drape called the millennium in terms of one of these other temples. Okay? You with me so far? Have I lost you? So you're with me. Okay. So, in other words, to start this process, we have to have at least a minimum understanding of how time itself is going to flow. All right. Now, I called this a moment ago a baseline. All right. So let's assume for a moment that this is sort of a baseline. I think all of us could step back, regardless of how we think of our eschatology, we could all step back and go, yeah, okay, that's basically human / redemptive history. God creates, Christ comes, God creates, man falls, Christ comes. And then we're waiting for a future time when Christ will come again. And then we know beyond that, we will be raised, and there will be a judgment, and the eternal state will come. Okay, so we can all agree on a general foundation of these tent poles, right? But let's just for a moment use something called a differentiated historical timeline. My name for it. A differentiated historical timeline. This baseline interpretation from the fall to Christ to the second coming of Christ is interpreted differently in some eschatological systems. In other words, the curtains hanging over the tent poles between the first and third of these tent poles, the original fall and the return of Christ, which would include the first coming of Christ in the middle, there is some difference of opinion about how to interpret that. And by the way, that interpretation, as you go through that time period, changes what you think when you get to this point at Christ's return. All right, so let me talk about a differentiated timeline. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm basically going to make a very rash assumption that there are basically two interpretations of this timeline. Okay, I say rash because I know there are others, but they're very tiny in terms of the number of people that adhere to them. There's two basic fundamental views of time, redemptive history, from the fall to the second return of Christ in the world today. Okay? So I'm being rash. I'm throwing out some other views, but they're so minor, it probably doesn't matter. Okay. The first one is what I would call, or what theologians call, a covenantal view of redemptive history. A covenantal view of redemptive history. In this particular view, the world is divided into two great covenants. Redemptive history is seen in this framework in two great covenants. One covenant that existed prior to the first tent pole, and another covenant that exists after the second tent pole. It's one that existed prior to the first, prior to the fall, and then exists a second one that exists after the first coming of Christ and goes forward. Okay? That first covenant we've talked about in a number of times because it's fundamental to Reformed theology. That first covenant that existed prior to Adam was called the covenant of... Say that louder. Works. The covenant of works. Okay. God made a covenant with Adam. The covenant that God made with Adam was that he was to okay, what before that though? Take dominion, that's one, but there's one right before that though. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and take dominion over all things. That first part can't be missed because be fruitful is part of the equation. Okay? So Adam was commanded be fruitful, multiply, take dominion over the earth, take dominion over all things. God says, I give you everything. It's yours. Do with it as you will. Take dominion over it. Now, the intention, of course, was for man, Adam, to take all of this in dominion to the glory of God. Right? Okay. And as part of that covenant of works, there was one specific prohibition, which was, don't eat from tree of, not life, the knowledge of good and evil. Okay, right. You were allowed to eat from the tree of life. Adam was, in fact, eat from the tree, please. Okay? Just don't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So that was a covenant of works. God said to Adam, and by extension to his wife Eve, be fruitful and multiply, take dominion over the earth, fill it up with people, use its resources, eat from the tree of life, have babies that have babies, and go out and cover the world with people and use it all because I've given it to you. That's just what you're supposed to do. With one small caveat, don't eat from that tree. Now, of course, Adam ate from the tree. And he broke then the covenant of works. So the original covenant of works then was broken at this first tent pole. So as I said, this was a covenant that existed prior to this first tent pole, okay? But a new covenant was established after the second tent pole, the coming of Christ, called the covenant of grace, okay? A covenant of grace given between God and man. Now, in reality, it's another covenant of works. Christ was to come and to do what Adam failed to do in the first place. He was to come and live obediently unto the law. He was to live that holy, righteous life. He was to go to a cross, die, put himself under the hands of wicked men in order to be crucified and be raised as a proof of that. It's not the word I was looking for, but as he comes out of the grave, he demonstrates that he succeeded at all that he was commanded to do. So, in theory, it was a covenant of works that was given to Jesus because it was between the Father and the Son, but it's really a covenant of grace because all of us are included in it by virtue of our trust in this Christ by the grace of God. God says, I will include you in what it is this Christ has done. So, he has included a number into this Christ by virtue of his grace. So, it's called a covenant of grace. And it begins then at this point where Christ lives, dies, is buried, raised, ascends. It's right here. So this new covenant is then established. Okay. Now, I realize there's another covenant out there that's off in eternity past out there. Remember, we called it the covenant of peace. It was a covenant between the Father and the Son in eternity past by which the Father would give a people to his Son and his Son would agree to go into the world. Okay, that's not a covenant with man. That's a covenant between the members of the Godhead. What I'm talking about here are the two great covenants that are made between the covenant between man and God, between Adam and then the second Adam who was to come. Now, those who see the world in this fashion then see the world along the lines of two great covenants. There's a covenant of works in which all men find themselves now condemned because the original covenant was broken. And so all future generations of Adam going in this direction find themselves now being included in Adam and fallen in Adam because of what Adam did. In his fall, he brought the entire human race with him into that condition until a covenant of grace was established. And then, as Paul says in Romans 5, a people now are taken out of Adam and they're placed into Christ. So they're in a new race of people into the second Adam, where now they live in him by virtue of the grace of God. So all of the other covenants that are made between the first and second tent poles are designed in this way of thinking to point forward to the covenant of grace. So the covenant that God made with Noah, the covenant that God made with Abraham, the covenant that God made with Moses, the covenant that God made with Aaron, the covenant that God made with David, they're all designed to look forward to the covenant of grace. The Noahic covenant. Noah gets in a boat, floats around, God keeps him safe, lands him, takes him out, and God says, okay, I'm making a covenant with you, I won't do that again. But it's by grace alone that Noah survived that. Abraham's the same way. God says, I'll come, I'll give you this land. Abraham says, what do I got to do? God says, well, just believe. Okay, I believe. God says, fine, we got a deal. The Mosaic Covenant even is designed to point forward to the Christ, because the Mosaic Covenant is designed, as Paul points out in the New Testament, to drive people to their knees before a God of grace, to show them just how far away from grace they are. And so as they try to keep the law and they fail at it miserably and the atonement system doesn't satisfy God, they're driven to fall down on their face and beg God for mercy. And God says, well, that's exactly what I want, because it's about grace through faith. So it's designed to point forward to the Christ. So those who see this timeline in a covenantal way simply see it as two great covenants that are established between God and man. One that's broken by the first Adam, and a second one that's kept by the second Adam, who comes and does perfectly what the first Adam could not do. So in this scenario, in a covenantal view of understanding this, redemptive history is simply broken into two phases. First phase being that which Adam was required to do and failed at. The second phase then, what it is that Christ would come to do. And so they, with these two phases then, the second phase is interpreting the events and the covenants of the first period between the first two tent poles as simply reflected in the church. So covenant folks say, okay, all of what God did in the Old Testament is all designed to point forward to what God is going to do in the covenant of grace. So even Israel as a people is simply a foreshadowing of what God is going to be doing in the new. So for covenantal people, they say, well, here's what happened. God elected a people in the Old Testament, called them to himself, gave them a law, gave them a land, set them in place as their God. They fell miserably into all kinds of sins and so forth because they couldn't keep their relationship with me, which is exactly what I was intending for it to happen, because all of it's designed to point forward to another elect people. And so in covenant way of thinking, in a covenant man's way of thinking, the church becomes the new Israel. The church becomes the new Israel. The old Israel has been done away with, because the old Israel was part of the old failure pointing forward to the new success. And so the old Israel is just a type and a shadow, just like all the sacrifices were, just like all the prophets were, etc., all pointing forward to the church, who now becomes the recipients of God's grace and mercy. So for covenantal people then, as they view the history of the world, you get to that third tent post when Christ comes back. How do they view Israel? Well, they interpret Israel as superseded by the church. The church becomes the new elect people. And so for them, the elect are the new Israel, replacing that old Israel, the patriarchs. Now catch this. Thus, the idea of a restored national Israel, a state of Israel, is unnecessary and superfluous. I mean, what do we need another Israel for? What do we need another nation called Israel for, if in point of fact, Israel's been replaced by an elect people? I mean, they would even appeal to passages like Paul, where he says, not all Israel is Israel. Right? In the book of Romans, chapters 9, 10, and 11, he's making the argument that there's a whole lot of people who call themselves Israel, but they're not really Israel in the truly elect sense. They may be Jewish by ethnicity, but they don't belong to Israel, because the only ones that belong to the true Israel are those who are trusting in Christ by faith. So the covenant person who hangs the drapes on these tent poles in this way simply divides one curtain as the old, pointing forward to a new curtain, which is the new, and pulls the curtain taut all the way to the end of time. Because this covenant of grace continues how long? Forever. For all eternity. Okay? Now, that's a covenantal view, but there is another view. I said there were two. And the other view is called a dispensational view of redemptive history. The dispensational view of redemptive history is divided into a number of dispensations. Depends on who you talk to. There's anywhere from 3 to 8 dispensations, usually 7. This particular idea was established in dispensationalism under such men as Darby and Schofield. However, when they initially established in dispensationalism the idea that of these different dispensations, they actually argued at the beginning of dispensationalism that God actually worked salvifically differently with people in each phase, in each dispensation, that people were saved differently in each dispensation. Schofield specific, I'm sorry. I'm thinking mid-1800s. The Schofield Reference Bible, you know, became very popular in the early 20th century. However, okay, I mentioned that because although that was the original understanding of Darby and Schofield, that position has been repudiated by most dispensationalists today. The idea that God saved people differently in each dispensation has pretty much been abandoned by most dispensationalists. They recognize that, no, God is always saved to people by grace through faith. Okay, but he relates to them differently in different time dispensations. He relates to them differently. Okay, so now they would hang on this framework going from the first tent post, the first tent pole here of the fall, to the return of Christ here. They would hang seven different drapes during that period of time. All right. The first one is the dispensation of innocence. Now this would be the time period prior to the fall. So the prior to the first tent pole, they would see a dispensation of innocence. Adam living his life in his natural innocence, no sin in the world. He's doing what he is to do. Fundamentally, what dispensationalists say is that this is man subject to God under his probation of keeping the primal command. So be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. Okay? Which leads to a second dispensation that begins at the point of the fall and travels to the flood, and it's called the dispensation of conscience. Man is subject to God during this period of time under his conscience as a creature created in the image of God. Cain killing Abel is a matter of conscience, or the effect of sin, if you will, in the world, up to the point of Noah. Apparently men's consciences were seared badly enough that at the point of the flood, God said, okay, that's enough. Which leads to a third dispensation, which begins at Noah and goes to Abraham. And more specifically, the Tower of Babel is the key event in this time frame. It's the dispensation of human government. Dispensation of human government. Man subject to God under human government, particularly the importance of life as seen in the enactment of the death penalty for murder. Murder and the death penalty became the key elements of human government in that case. So during this dispensation, man related to God by virtue of human government. God establishes human government. The Tower of Babel, you remember, was a giant government. And so the idea is that man is subject to God under that. Which then leads to the fourth dispensation. And that's from Abraham to Moses. The dispensation of promise. The promise made specifically to Abraham. Man subject to God under his promise to be God and bless a specific people. I should say to be their God and to be a specific people. So God has made a promise to Abraham. I'm going to raise you up. I'm going to give you great descendants. I'm going to make a covenant with you that this land will be yours, etc. So there's a great promise. And so man during that time frame relates to God specifically in relation to this promise, which leads, of course, to the dispensation of the law, or the dispensation of law is probably a better way to put it. Moses to Christ. All of the 1400 year period of time from 14 BC to Christ. Man subject to God under the law of Sinai. The dispensation of law. Which then leads to the sixth dispensation, and that is the dispensation of grace. So the dispensation of law is this lengthy period of time before Christ, which comes to a dispensation of grace after Christ. And this, of course, is man subject to God under the call to faith in Christ. This dispensation is often called the church age. The church age, or the age of the church. We're living in it. We're living in this dispensation, according to dispensationalists. Which leads then to a final dispensation. This is the seventh, and that is the dispensation of the millennial kingdom. So an event in the future, a thousand-year reign of Christ on the earth in the future, where man is subject to God under the peace established by Christ. A literal time frame. Now, depends on who you ask in terms of dispensationalism as to where it fits in terms of that third tent pole. Okay? Some put the third tent pole at the beginning of the millennium. Some put the third tent pole at the middle of the, and so forth. Well, no, not the middle of the millennium. Most of them, I should say, I'm sorry, let me rephrase that. Most, if not all, dispensationalists are premillennials. They put the tent pole of the return of Christ at the beginning of the millennium. So the millennium starts after that third tent pole. Okay? So, in dispensationalism then, redemptive history is seen through what is called a literal grammatical historical lens of the events of the past, whereby the events of the past are progressively seen, each dispensation adding something to the next. So there's a progression. So you start out with a simple innocence, you move to a condition of conscience, and then up to more of human government, and then you begin to move to promise and law and to grace, and so each one is building up what comes from the previous dispensation progressively. Now, dispensationalists insist that they're only the only ones that use a literal grammatical approach. They're wrong about that. There are many of us Reformed people who use a literal grammatical approach. We just don't take a dispensational perspective to the drapes. We interpret, for example, Genesis 1, 2, and 3 as literal. That would be a literal historical grammatical approach. So it's not quite true to say that they're the only ones that do that. But they are very literal in their approach to these things. They understand that the history of Israel is the history of a literal people to which literal promises are made by God, and thus they are retained. They cannot be done away with by virtue of being superseded by another group in the future. Abraham, according to the dispensationalists, was given a promise by God that he would occupy this land. His people were given a promise that they would be his descendants, and therefore Israel is a special people who will eventually receive these promises. Now you will notice what that means then. How would they then interpret the nation of Israel when you get to the third tent post? And the answer is they would see Israel as a literal reality. They would see Israel as distinct from the elect in the New Testament. They would see Israel as one group. They would see the elect as another group. Okay? So they would understand a national Israel, a state of Israel, literally. They would celebrate, in fact, the 1947 establishment of a nation state called Israel, because they would see it as a literal promise of God to establish his people in the very land that they themselves were established in. The covenantal guy says, well, wait a minute, there's an old covenant and a new covenant. The new covenant has a new people, so the old Israel has been superseded by a new people, so we don't need a state. Dispensationalists come along and said, that nation had certain promises and specifically given by God. Therefore, when we get to the end, we are going to have we should have then, as part of the process, a national Israel to be dealt with. Am I describing dispensations fairly? Okay. Let me point out something to you. The dispensational eschatology is the default in American Christianity. It is the default in American Christianity. You want me to prove it? I can prove it like this. What is the United States policy towards Israel? Is it covenantal or is it dispensational? It's clearly dispensational, isn't it? Because what does the United States believe? That Israel has every right to exist, and in fact, most of the modern policy related to Israel finds its roots in early dispensationalism in the 20th century, even before Israel was established as a nation. And the United States formally recognized the state of Israel, not because they simply popped up and needed to be recognized, but because the vast majority of American Christians are dispensationalists in their eschatological approach, believing that there should be a national Israel, because that's what we believe about how the curtains are hung on this framework. See it? So dispensationalism is the default, thus our policy towards Israel. Okay, so what I wanted you to notice is there's two different ways, really, of interpreting the space between the first tent post and the third tent post, the return of Christ. Okay, there's two ways to understand this, and both of those ways will push themselves into how you will understand the rest of the flow as it comes from the third tent post. So what we're going to do now, in the next weeks, Lord willing, is go to the third tent post then, and begin to talk about what we will see coming from that particular point. So we're going to be talking about the return of Christ, the millennium, the resurrection, the judgment, and the eternal state. Okay, you will notice I'm putting three tent posts there. The return of Christ, the resurrection, the judgment. Those three tent posts are automatically there. We have to talk about the millennium because everybody does. And of course, we need to talk about what happens after the final tent pole in terms of eternity. Okay? But now you have an idea of why it is that there are two very divergent views of history and how it's understood. Okay? So you get to decide which one you want to believe.